I've been shopping at my local Costco since I was a child. It was one of the only places my father ever took me to. The beautiful man, my father, was the only family I ever knew. He liked to shop often and said it was the way that he had gotten my mother when he had nothing because, well, at least he could afford her stuff from there whenever he could. When I was 21, my father had died in his sleep from a broken heart that yearned for my mother, and I was left all alone. Grief stripped me off everything except Costco. I could work 40 hours a week for cheap, but one gets a sense that money was not the only reason that people would shop at Costco. Every piece of clothing that passed my neck was from the local Costco. It was the timeline of the decade. The Costco was the only thing of permanence that remained in my life. But it became familiar. I knew my way around every row, and I was convinced that I could march through the aisles with my eyes closed, and it was what was happening for the most part, as I was too dizzy to observe my surroundings. In the usual way that I would shop at Costco, I had gone on that strange evening when everything would change for me in a matter of suddenness that I struggled to process with. I remember I had a gray top on, and it was what I had on that drew the stranger to me. The inscription on the shirt had been simple but rebellious. It was an 80s hip-hop band called NWA. The tag read, "F the Police." I didn't think too much about it since I had plenty of other shirts like it in my closet, and I didn't really know that much about rap. I was picking up some blouses from the rack when someone came up behind me and seized me by the wrist. His hands were firm and calloused, witnessing the fact that he was someone used to laboring at some hard activity. As hard as his palm was, it was cold. It was that which caused me to flinch, but his hands did not let go, wrapped around my wrist like a wrench. "Annette," he called me in a strange East European accent, as my eyes drifted to his face. He was a young man, cleanly shaven and a neatly pressed shirt tucked in. He had a handsome face, the type that could fulfill a teenager's wild fantasy. But suddenly I pulled my hands from his wrist and he yielded. "You have the wrong person, sir," I said to him in a calm tone as I could say. Almost as soon as I said those words, I saw his face transform through emotions from light to heavy brooding that made his brows fall askew. I couldn't have known what he thought in contemplation, and his foreign features provided no clue. I chalked it up to mere confusion, but even those who were confused at approaching a stranger, I thought that maybe it was someone that he knew and showed remorse quickly and apologized for the error. It could have been dismissed as some light humor, as everyone makes mistakes, but this man that was in front of me had an unwavering presence. "Annette," he called me again, and now I knew something strange was happening. I took a step back. He was at least 6'5", with muscular arms that could seize me without much resistance. I had an awry feeling sweep over me, and the charm or whatever aura that he had over me that made me feel relaxed wore off. I was now wary, but I did not show my panic. "Excuse me?" I looked around the aisle, when I was to discover that I was alone. "Anybody there?" He furrowed his brows and placed a solitary finger on his lips to silence me. He hissed through his fingers, and I obeyed unwittingly. My rapidly beating heart paralyzed my body. Sheer terror that I could not process ravaged my senses. I couldn't move, even if I wanted to run. As far as my legs could carry me away from the menacing glower I was confronted with, I was fixed to my spot as he made his move towards me and placed his hand on my shoulder. "You will come with me, and your name is Annette when you try to pay, or I will bash your head against the floor so hard you will be unrecognizable for when the coroner finds you," he said to me, his accent cleared up. "I know you're alone." It felt like a nightmare from that moment. It felt like a nightmare, a blur, worsening, and I almost fainted. But it was happening, and I was no fool to think otherwise. I was being kidnapped, to be trafficked. I couldn't feel my legs. I was so terrified of the many things that could go wrong in my life. How I didn't think that this was a possibility. No wonder his hands were so cold and hard. My body quivered on its own, and my stomach rumbled loudly. "I'll pay," he said, as we made our way to the counter. I watched my hope evaporate with every step that led me into this horrifying maze. A nightmare. The voices in my head echoed loudly. I had the thought of resisting, but I knew that it would come with great bodily harm. He knew I was alone. I was so shaken by the entire episode, and my incapacity to process what was happening, I didn't even realize that it drew the attention of one of the reps at the Costco counter. "Did I give the items you wanted to you, Claire?" I heard a beautiful woman say, and the words thumped into my hearing without distinction. I looked behind me to see if she was talking to someone else. "My name isn't Claire," I thought in my head. But when I looked back, our eyes met. "Come, come," she said. And just as she did, she pulled me to her, and the strange man held my hands. She smiled at him. "Sorry, she ordered some stuff recently, and I wanted to hand it to her." To avoid the scene, he released my hands, and in a second I heard a yelling from across the stall. "Get down on the ground!" Two cops had materialized out of thin air, ordering him to stand down. When he resisted, they shot him with a tase gun. My heart was still whipping wild in my chest. They grabbed the man from the ground when he tried to resist, and they cuffed him before taking him away. Damn these traffickers. I knew he was dangerous the moment I saw him coming in, and I saw him watching you. The rep said to me, "Hey, be safe out there."
I live in a small town in New Mexico. We don't have a lot of things to do here besides go off-roading through the desert or hanging out at our one skate park. Last year, the town next to us got a brand new Costco. It was enormous. At any time of day, there were more people walking around that store than the entire population of my town, and it had everything. The prices weren't too bad either. The problem with a big store like that is how it pushes out its competition, especially in rural areas like mine. Within 6 months of its opening, most of the shops in a 100-mile radius had to close down. Nothing could compete. My little town was all but destroyed. We still had one market, but that was really struggling. Everything else shuttered. So when I got my job at Costco, I kept it a secret from all my neighbors. I worked there 5 days a week, usually the night shift. I figured no one would find out because it was in the next town, and if anyone saw me working there, that meant they were customers themselves, so they wouldn't spill my secret. After a few months, I saved up a lot of money. Plus, none of my neighbors had figured out where I worked. I thought things could go on like this forever, or at least until I had enough saved up to move away. That's when something happened. My pickup truck broke down on the long highway connecting our town with the next town over. I was driving to work at the time, ready to spend all shift unloading a new shipment of beanbag chairs. I tried to call a tow truck, but my phone was dead. I waited on the side of the road until another car stopped next to mine. It was Nadine, one of my neighbors. Nadine hated Costco more than anyone else I knew. She lost her antique store after Costco moved in, and even though Costco definitely didn't sell antiques, she blamed the big store for her loss of customers. I desperately needed Nadine to drive me, but I couldn't tell her that. She'd absolutely flip out. When she offered me a ride, I told her no, but I asked if I could borrow her phone to call a tow truck. She didn't have one. Of course she didn't. So she asked me again if I needed a ride. It was already getting dark, and I seriously didn't want to be alone on the road at night. So I braced myself and told her that I needed a ride to Costco. Her eyes lit up, but not in an angry way. "Wow, that's exactly where I'm going. Hop in." I couldn't believe it. When had she changed her mind? I thought she'd be furious with me. Breathing a sigh of relief, I crawled into her truck and she started driving. We sat in silence for a while. The long road stretched out in front of us until Nadine asked, So, why are you going to Costco? I work there now, I told her. And you? She laughed for a second. It was a cold laugh. Then she said, check out the back. She was talking about the bed of her truck. I looked behind me and gasped. There were explosives back there. Are you going to blow up the building? I asked. She laughed again. Tell me this is a joke. She didn't say anything. Her truck began to speed up. She was going over 80. If I tried to jump out the door, I'd be splattered against the road. Please, you can't do this. You know I have to, she said. All I gotta do is drive into that building and boom, everything will be better. I begged her to change her mind. She wasn't a killer. She was a good person at heart. She didn't listen. Her mind was made up. I tried to grab at her steering wheel, but she shoved me hard. I fell back against the window. If you make me crash, she said, then we'll both explode. You of all people know how dangerous explosives are. She was right. I was raised by a firefighter dad who taught me all about explosives and gun safety and all sorts of survival stuff. That's when I realized that I didn't need to stop Nadine at all. I just needed to defuse those bombs. As she continued speeding down the highway, I slid open the window behind us and crawled into the trunk bed. Nadine didn't bother trying to stop me. She didn't think I'd be able to thwart her plan. There were three separate boxes of explosives in the bed, each one shaking horribly from the bumpy road, even though they were duct taped to the truck. It was terrifying to be so close to something that could kill me in less than a second. I reached the first of the three explosives and saw a bunch of wires and cords. There wasn't a timer or anything, but it looked like it was set to explode on impact. All I had to do was clip one of the wires. I knew which one too. Unfortunately, I didn't have any scissors. From inside the truck, Nadine started laughing. You don't have any time. I'll be there in 2 minutes. She was right. We were starting to pass more and more buildings as we got closer to town. I reached my face toward the explosive and bit into the wire. It was the only thing I could think of. A spark shocked my tongue, but I was able to defuse it safely. Thank God. Then I crawled over to the second box. I could feel the truck speeding up. Nadine saw what I'd done and knew that she had to reach Costco before I could defuse the other two bombs. The second device looked exactly the same as the first. Once again, I bit into the wire and its digital screen faded to black. It too was defused. We passed by more cars and streetlights. The Costco building was just ahead. I had less than a minute before she'd drive into the building. I frantically grabbed the third device. This one was placed upside down in its box, meaning I'd have to pick up the whole device and flip it around if I wanted to reach the right wire. And I didn't have time. My trunk jumped wildly as Nadine drove over the raised sidewalk and into the Costco parking lot. I ripped the third device out of the box and pulled it to my chest. At the very last second, I bit into the wire and grabbed onto the side of the truck, bracing for impact. My whole body flew into the air as Nadine's truck slammed straight into the side of the building. After that, I blacked out. When I woke up, paramedics were gathered all around me, checking my pulse and shining lights into my eyes. I asked them what happened. A police officer stepped forward and thanked me for defusing all three bombs. If I hadn't been there, a lot more people would have died. This whole building would be rubble. How did I survive the crash? I mumbled. He nodded toward the building where Nadine's truck was crushed against the wall, right next to a giant pile of beanbag chairs that were waiting to be brought inside. You landed in the perfect spot, the policeman said. I can't believe how lucky you are. I spent the next few days recovering in the hospital. A bunch of people came to visit, including my boss. She offered me a pretty big bonus because of all the people I'd saved. And as for Nadine, she died on impact, the only casualty that night.
I'm not the worst looking guy, so everyone has always tried to set me up. My friends, family, and coworkers all knew a girl that was perfect for me. They knew I hated dating apps because I somehow always attracted the clingiest girls. I swear, stage 5 clingers had a sixth sense for me. I let my sister set me up one time with one of her friends, but she talked about her two cats the entire time. I may have been perfect for her, but she was not perfect for me. I didn't let anyone set me up again until my mom suggested Jessica, the daughter of one of her church friends. Jessica and I had known each other since middle school. She was always one of the weird, kind of ugly girls, but she grew up to be a smoke show. When my mom suggested it, I didn't hesitate to say yes. I wanted the date to go well, so I planned something special. From what I knew, Jessica was a school teacher. She really enjoyed reading and drawing. Overall, she sounded like a normal, well-adjusted lady. I planned for us to have a picnic on a lake, and if it went well, we could take a rowboat out in the water, like they did in The Notebook. Jessica looked stunning when we met at the park. She wore a baby blue dress that hugged her curves and let her auburn hair fall around her face in loose curls. She was impressed by the picnic. Jessica told me that a guy had never put so much thought into a date with her. I told her all the other guys were fools for not going all out for her. The date was going well, until she started going on about something called a twin flame. Apparently, she was part of a digital school dedicated to helping people find their twin flames, and her pastor confirmed that I was her twin flame.
So what are they, like soulmates? I asked uneasily.
Kind of. Jessica was eager to talk about it. Twin flames are much more passionate than soulmates. They're meant to push each other to grow into the people we're supposed to be.
Okay, I started. How do you know it's me?
Because the pastor confirmed it. He and his wife had special insight and can identify twin flames. I brought you up in one of our sessions, and without hesitation, he said it was you. It's exciting. Not everyone meets their twin flame in their lifetime, so we've been given a gift.
The whole thing was a major turnoff for me. Jessica was hot, sure, but she was too crazy for me. She talked about moving in with each other on our first date, and I had to tell her that she was moving a little fast for me. And by the end, I just wanted to get away from her.
After the date, I texted her, telling her I thought it would be best for us to remain friends because I wasn't interested in pursuing anything romantic with her. Jessica freaked out. She sent me about 20 texts about how I was spiritually blocked, and if I enrolled in this class, which was $2,000, I would see the truth. Jessica went crazy. I had to block her on everything, but that didn't stop her. She created new accounts to message me. She started following me. Soon enough, I saw her everywhere. Bars, restaurants, grocery stores. I had to find new places to go, but she always sniffed me out. I ended up getting a restraining order and had to call the police one time to detain her. I told my mom to talk to her friend to get a handle on her daughter. The school Jessica talked about turned out to be some type of digital cult, so Jessica cut ties with her family entirely. None of them have heard from her to this day. The real trouble started when I began dating my now wife, Betty. Betty and I met at a bar and hit it off. She was an accountant and wanted to take things slow. Jessica learned about Betty and started harassing her online. She told Betty that our relationship would never be as passionate as Jessica's and mine's. But Betty thought I was cheating on her and had to assure that Jessica was just a nut job in a cult. Jessica started stalking Betty. She started dressing and talking like her. She started going to the same gym as her and copied Betty's routine. Jessica even tried to befriend Betty, but Betty knew who she was and told her to leave her alone.
Betty and I got more serious to the point that I proposed to her. I was nervous about how Jessica would respond, because her pastor encouraged her to go to the extreme lengths to convince me we had some type of divine union. Honestly, I was scared that she would show up to the wedding or something. But what she did do was so much worse. Betty told me it went down like this. Betty was in the locker room of her gym just after working out when Jessica approached her. "Nice ring," Jessica began. Betty felt uneasy but responded, thank you. She turned back to getting her things out of her locker. "You guys will never work out. Surely you can realize that," Jessica said. Betty didn't even respond and shrugged at her. "He's my twin flame. If you really care about him, you'll leave him alone so he and I can live in divine union. It's what's best for him." Betty did not want to engage, but Jessica would not leave. She kept going on and on about the whole divine union thing, and our pastor confirmed it. Betty told her, "Look, I'm sorry, but he told me that he didn't feel much chemistry with you. I know you think this is some spiritual connection, but we are in love, and I would appreciate it if you left us alone." "I will never leave him alone. He is my twin flame." Betty lost it at this point. "No, he's not. You're in a cult that brainwashed you into stalking us. Leave me alone." Jessica then pulled out a switchblade and sliced Betty's arm. "Jesus Christ!" Betty looked down at her bleeding arm. Jessica pushed her against the locker and taunted her with the knife. "Would he still love you if you were scarred for life?" Betty tried to fight Jessica off, but Jessica was bigger than her. Jessica took the knife and cut a deep line on Betty's cheek from her hairline to her nose. By then, a worker came in to do regular maintenance and saw what was happening. The worker pushed Jessica down, asking Betty if she was okay helping her. Betty was in shock and could not stop crying. After calling 911, they took Jessica away in handcuffs. I ran and met Betty at the hospital. Half of her face was bandaged. Are you okay?" I asked Betty. She wasn't, pointing out that she was going to charge Jessica with assault, which could lead to her going to prison. Betty said that she would finally leave us alone if she was behind bars. We immediately got to work figuring out how to press charges. Jessica was sentenced to 2 years in prison, charged with assault with a deadly weapon, and 3 years of probation. Not as long as we hoped, but for a couple years, all Jessica would do was send me letters, and she sent many. She's still in jail, and I'm hoping that once she's out, the stipulation of her bothering us again is bad enough that she just stays away.
In the last few months, I'd gotten tired of TikTok and Instagram. Everything felt either really fake or really stupid. It all seemed like a huge waste of time. Even worse, I had to delete my Twitter after posting some dumb joke about BTS that had instantly turned viral in all the wrong ways. I got thousands of angry messages, and I couldn't handle that kind of vitriol. I figured I'd try out Omegle. The idea of anonymously chatting with strangers seemed like a nice change of pace. Even if I accidentally said something offensive, I'd just get skipped. Nothing would happen to me. At least, that's what I thought. The first night, I spent a couple of hours in random conversation with people from my age from all over the world. One guy even serenaded me with his guitar. He wasn't very good, but it was still pretty cute. I met a couple creepers, but I skipped them quickly. All in all, it was a nice, low-pressure experience. The next night was a bit different. I talked with this guy from Atlanta for a bit, but when I said something slightly political, he skipped me. Whatever, that was fine. But then the next person popped up on my screen. It was an Asian girl about my age. She had a teddy bear in her lap, and her whole room was decorated pink. We spoke for a bit, and everything seemed to be going well, but after a while, her expression changed, as if she recognized me from somewhere. I don't remember what I was talking about, but she cut me off and asked, "Are you 5-star-4-7? I gulped. That was my old Twitter handle before I deleted the account. At that exact moment, I noticed the posters behind her. They were all BTS. No, I lied. I don't know what you mean. She did not buy it. She stared at me for a long time, and I could see the raw hatred in her eyes. She knew exactly who I was. She started to say something, but I very quickly skipped her and started the next conversation. That night, I could not sleep. I kept thinking about that girl's expression. It was so dark, so angry. She looked like she really wanted to hurt me. I played back our conversation in my head. Had I said anything that gave away where I lived? Had I told her anything that could help her track me down? I didn't think so. I didn't mention my real name, or my city, or any other personal information besides what kind of movies I liked. The thought was comforting. There was no way that BTS fan would be able to track me down. I was calm enough to start drifting to sleep. But before I did, I realized that the wall in my dorm room had a banner of my college. It would have been visible when my laptop was on. Would that be enough information for her to track me down? It didn't seem likely. Still, I could barely sleep that night. After a few days, I'd forgotten about the interaction. I continued to go on Omegle and meet new people, and everything seemed to be normal. Then, one night, I woke up to a loud, shattering noise. My dorm window had burst open. I pushed myself out of bed and saw that someone had thrown a brick into my room. I looked through the broken window and no one was outside. The grassy area next to the building was dark and empty. Then I checked out the brick. It was large and gray, and on one side there was a message written in Sharpie. BTS forever. Crap, I whispered to myself. That girl had found me. I reported the incident with the campus police, and they assured me that they'd look into the security camera footage to see if they could identify the brick thrower. They never got back to me. The next day, I was walking to one of my classes when I saw a flash mob outside the student union. I realized with horror that they were dancing to a BTS song. The science wing only had one door, so I had to walk past them if I wanted to get to class. With my heart beating fast, I walked around the dancers, my head hung low. I thought that I'd made it into the building, but when I looked over my shoulder, I saw that the flash mob had shifted direction. They were dancing right towards me. Their moves were still perfect and synchronized, but they were all staring at me. The girl from Omegle was right in the center. All at once, they did a dance move where they crossed their fingers over their throats threateningly. I raced inside. All throughout chemistry, I was worried about what was waiting for me outside. I made sure to leave with the rush of students, trying to stay as inconspicuous as possible. But when I got back into the courtyard, I didn't see any dancers. Instead, I saw the entire student body staring at me. That's when I realized that there were posters all over the brick walls. Someone had plastered a blown-up screenshot of my BTS tweet everywhere, right next to a photo of my face with black X's over the eyes. I raced to campus security and explained what happened. I told them everything, and the old security guard stared at me with a confused expression.
"You're saying," he said, "that people are terrorizing you because you posted something about some boy band?"
"Yes," I told him. He just laughed and told me to calm down. If all this was over some stupid band, things would blow over soon enough. I wasn't so sure. The next night, I tried to sleep. I even took some NyQuil to help. As I was dozing off, I heard a soft scratching noise. Someone was at my door trying to pick the lock.
Go away!
I shouted. I heard laughter through the door. There were at least 3 people on the other side, maybe more. I jumped out of bed, woozy from the NyQuil, and pushed my dresser against the door. The scratching stopped. The board that covered my broken window popped open. People started to climb inside. It was dark, so I couldn't see them at first, but I knew that the first one to climb in was that girl. She landed with a thump on my carpet and started walking toward me. 3 others were behind her. Even in the dark, I could see they were all wearing BTS shirts. "I'm sorry," I said. "Please stop." The girl didn't stop. Giggling, she pulled something out of her pocket. It was a lighter. She stood inches away from me and started clicking the lighter on and off, on and off.
"What do you want?"
I screamed. She didn't say anything.
"Please," I told her. I was wrong. I love BTS. Their music's incredible. And I love their dance.
That seemed to be all she needed to hear. She shoved the lighter back in her pocket and left. They all climbed out the window. I sat there alone in my dorm for the longest time, barely able to breathe. Since then, the attacks have stopped. I haven't been on Omegle since, and just in case, I wear a BTS pin on my shirt every day, for protection.